This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, in for Joshua Johnson. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. In an attempt to overthrow Venezuela's President Maduro this week, plotters have seen their attempted coup fizzle. In France, President Macron grapples with how to address the demands of angry yellow vesters. Japan's chrysanthemum throne has a new emperor, and some big footprints are spotted in Nepal, renewing speculation about the existence of Bigfoot. Here with me to talk about some of the week's most interesting stories from all around the world, Nina Maria Potts. She's director of global news coverage at Feature Story News. Good to see you again, Nina.
Good to be here.
Greg Myrie is national security correspondent for NPR. Greg, great to have you here.
Hey, good to be here.
And Amna Nawaz is national correspondent and substitute anchor for PBS NewsHour. Welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start, gang, in Venezuela, because according to Tim Padgett, America's editor for WLRN, Juan Guaido is now 0-for-3 in attempts to incite regime change, a coup in Venezuela. Clashes between pro-government and opposition supporters in Venezuela this week left at least 4 people dead, hundreds of people injured. Opposition leader Juan Guaido has asked Venezuelans to protest every day until Nicolas Maduro leaves the government. Guaido told Fox Business Network, quote, "As long as we are mobilized and united, we are very close to achieving our freedom. Can't tell you a specific date or time. Working on transition. Democracy has always taken time." Greg Myrie, how serious is this latest challenge to Maduro's rule?
It's serious. We've seen this drag on for months. I'm not going to make any predictions, but it could go any number of ways. And while journalists and many observers are looking for some sort of quick change or resolution to this, it hasn't gotten very violent, and it certainly could. So, I mean, a quick, dramatic change in a country that's still very divided, where Maduro still has the military on his side, could mean a lot of bloodshed. And so far, we've seen clashes, but not large-scale bloodshed. So I think hoping for something to happen quickly isn't necessarily mean a nice, peaceful resolution. It could mean something more ominous.
Nina Maria Potts, what's Nicolas Maduro's status at this point? I mean, we mentioned 0-for-3. This is an ongoing grinding struggle. Even when there aren't coup attempts in Venezuela, there are people in the streets sometimes rioting for food, for the basics, for medical care.
Well, it's a very good question. I think we're still trying to unravel what went wrong for Guaido this week. In terms of Maduro's status, there was a lot of speculation that he was on the tarmac, ready to leave when Guaido appeared with this handful of military officials on Tuesday. It was deemed very suspicious that he didn't make a televised address or even phone in to address the nation, and he didn't appear until very late at night. And the suggestion is that he had been just about to exit before Russian intervention. I mean, I think one of the big challenges for the Trump administration right now, as it weighs up how far it's prepared to go, is what it does next and whether it consults the Lima Group and whether it gets Latin American support on board. There is speculation that Guaido himself is trying to get himself arrested to provoke a U.S. military intervention. And there is also speculation about the role of Lopez, who has claimed that he's been in negotiation for some time with military officials, but his appearance by surprise alongside Guaido, who he mentored, I think there's a suggestion that people inside the Maduro regime that had been trying to strike a deal with Guaido for a couple of months now were alarmed by Lopez's appearance because he's considered a hothead and unpredictable.
And Amna Nawaz, the Venezuelan High Court has ordered the arrest of Leopoldo Lopez. Mm-hmm. And in these situations, we tend to watch for who is close to the leadership of either side who falls away and breaks over to the other side, whether it's an important military general who abandons the government or a leader of the opposition who decides to bow out. These are the things we watch for.
That's right. And I think that's one of the things, obviously, U.S. officials are watching for as well. One of the conversations we've been having since those protests started in the streets was, how bad was the U.S. miscalculation? did we not know, intelligence-wise, that Guaido did not have as much military support at the top brass level that would obviously make this 0-3 now? And I think the big question moving forward, and we don't want to speculate about what happens next, is what the U.S. is prepared to do. You saw Secretary Pompeo go out as soon as the protests began and said, look, the U.S. stands prepared to do whatever is necessary. But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has basically said, we're really hesitant about getting involved militarily here.
And I want to talk about the White House response, the American response in a country that has good reason to be extremely suspicious anytime America's eyes are on their country because of their history. But you all mentioned the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Let's give the Secretary his turn here.
We've watched throughout the day. It's been a long time since anyone has seen Maduro. He had an airplane on the tarmac. He was ready to leave this morning, as we understand it, and the Russians indicated he should stay. We think the situation remains incredibly fluid. We know that there were senior leaders inside the Maduro government that were prepared to leave. They told us as much over the past few weeks, and we're convinced that the Venezuelan people are going to get their democracy back.
Greg Myrie, the Secretary of State, says Nicolas Maduro was on the tarmac ready to leave, and the Russians said, no, you should stay. What do we know about that? Is that a true claim? Did that happen?
I don't know that to be true. I'm not sure where it is. I think the way I would read this, a lot of signaling going on. The U.S. is trying to put as much pressure on Maduro as possible, scare him into thinking that things are about to fall apart. He should get on a plane and get out of there, perhaps encourage people to come out and protest. So I think the U.S. is signaling the same way the sides are in Venezuela. I don't know what the U.S. is planning to do, but I think this president and the U.S. military both have a lot of hesitation about getting involved militarily and owning this. I think you need to really see this as a lot of messaging that all sides are trying to nudge their supporters and their people to get the outcome they want.
And the effectiveness of that tough rhetoric comes into stark relief when the military itself or national security advisors are reluctant to put any steel behind the words. But Nina Maria Potts, I want to ask about the U.S. strategy here. Like I just mentioned, Venezuelans are extremely suspicious of the United States government, almost in any form it comes in. This coup is grassroots. It's homegrown, attempted coup, I should say, uprising against the government. There is reason to believe that there's legitimate popular opposition to a government we don't like. But a lot of people sit here in Washington and say, administration, keep quiet. If you come out strongly and loudly for Juan Guaido, it's going to turn people off in Venezuela because, frankly, they don't want to hear that the United States is on their side.
Well, a couple of things on that point. I mean, I think in referencing military officials high up and top brass, we shouldn't also forget the fact that there are armed civilians, pro-Maduro armed civilians roaming the streets of Caracas at night, trying to keep the population and the public under control, who are being paid for by the military and the government. And in terms of grassroots, I think it's an extraordinary assumption to imagine that Guaido enjoys widespread popular support. I think that there are plenty of families in rural areas and the working population of Caracas that still support Maduro and are deeply suspicious of the U.S., as you referenced. I mean, I think the other key point about the U.S. strategy in Venezuela is that President Trump has obviously made Venezuela a top priority. He claimed credit for mobilizing the international community, 50 countries getting in behind Guaido. And the stakes are quite high. I think what this week has shown is that regime change is just simply not straightforward.
Ben on Facebook writes to us, Venezuela's crisis is the result of petrostate, corruption, and ineptitude, not simply socialism. Amna Nawaz, this is a situation that's much more complicated than the rhetoric would indicate.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a confluence of factors that got Venezuela to where it was before this became the conflict it is today. And it's also worth pointing out, just to touch on another part of the U.S. response, is they have now clearly drawn a red line. It is no longer Maduro needs to step down. It's Maduro needs to go. He needs to get on a plane and he needs to get out. Secretary Pompeo was very clear about that. There's also some reporting out there that if they can't support him militarily or choose not to for a number of reasons, maybe they can do so financially in some way. So the U.S. is not out of this by any means. And at the same time, we should remind people the crisis that's on the ground right now affecting all those people, that exodus of 1.2 million folks, the aid backed up at the border, that's getting getting worse the longer this drags on. But
as the U.S. military hesitates to do anything militarily in Venezuela, Greg Myrie, we hear news about Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, his private army. He was a character in the Mueller report. He is the brother of Betsy DeVos, the education secretary. And now there's some reporting that he's been working, advocating to sending his own private army in to help overthrow Maduro. What do we know?
He, as you say, he keeps popping up. I think I don't know who would be supporting that. It's hard to imagine the U.S. government would, again, want their fingerprints on something like this. Guaido has certainly talked about a peaceful protest. It's not clear who would be supporting him. And is this just sort of Eric Prince leaking his own name as he has in other situations, talking about, you know, in Iraq or Afghanistan, offering to send in private contractors. So I'm very skeptical of these reports. It's hard to imagine who would be in favor of this besides perhaps Eric Prince.
Well, Nina Maria Potts, do we have any reason to believe that the White House or the president himself would be receptive to a pitch by Eric Prince for a private mercenary army to take care of things in Venezuela?
I agree with Greg. It's incredibly difficult to read the signals. I want to get back very briefly to the humanitarian crisis. You know, our team on the ground is getting running water still for 15 minutes a day, and that's a stark reminder. And these are our journalists who are pretty well paid by Venezuelan standards.
And it is incredibly real in Venezuela, and there is a massive humanitarian challenge there as well. Why did the leader of ISIS appear in a video for the first time in 5 years? Why do France's yellow vest protesters take to the streets? And tributes are paid to former Senator Richard Lugar for his many contributions to world peace. All ahead with Greg Myrie of NPR, Amna Nawaz of PBS NewsHour, and Nina Maria Potts of Feature Story News. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you on the Friday News Roundup. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. We're talking about the top stories from around the world with journalist Amna Nawaz of PBS NewsHour, Greg Myrie of NPR, and Nina Maria Potts of Feature Story News. Gang, let's go to Iraq, or at least I think we're going to Iraq. It's really unclear where this next story has actually come from. After staying quiet for 5 years, often reported dead, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, appeared this week on a 17-minute video. We're going to spare you the full version here, but here's a brief sampling. Baghdadi appears bearded, looking relatively well. He makes a range of excuses for the loss of certain battles and lists some of those who died in the fight for the caliphate. The New York Times translated part of that video that I just played for you. He says, quote, "Our battle today is a battle of attrition, and we will prolong it for the enemy, and that they might know that our jihad will continue until the judgment day," end quote. Amna Nawaz, what did you take away from this video?
Well, one thing, he confirms that the territorial control that they once had has been gone. So, you know, White House is right about that. Administration is right about that. Territorially, we have been winning that battle. At the same time, you don't come out after 5 years of silence unless you think it is worth the risk. Because obviously, a leader of that stature, you're putting forward a lot of clues about where you might be. It's obviously intelligence teams working to unpack forensically whatever they can, whatever clues they can pull from that video. But that was a message that was delivered very deliberately, clearly not ad-libbed. There was some very specific messaging about the power and control that they still exercise, which is not necessarily on the ground in Iraq and Syria, but it is online. There was a reason that he name-checked the people that he did. There was a reason that he name-checked the countries that he did. And it was basically a call to arms to say, we still pose a very real international threat.
President Trump and his government have, of course, declared in the past that ISIS has been defeated. It seems like al-Baghdadi with this video is trying to show the world something very, very different.
Well, look, the One of the men that he named, one of the French brothers, was believed to be linked to the Paris attacks and believed to be killed in a U.S. airstrike in Syria a while ago. The countries that he named are places where they've all had links to ISIS at the very least. This is the challenge now for intelligence services across the world. And this is something that we don't have a handle on, is how to battle these ideas online, where they are proven to be even more dangerous to some degree, because it's not a military fight. It's not a fight-win-hold situation. This is going to be the future of this battle against extremist views.
Greg?
Yeah, I think you have to keep two conflicting ideas in your head at the same time here. One, ISIS is clearly not completely destroyed. Baghdadi can appear on a video. U.S. intelligence estimates are there at least 14,000 ISIS fighters out there somewhere, mostly scattered around the border between Iraq and Syria. They could regroup. They could cause another problem. On the other hand, there's no caliphate, and there's no immediate prospect that there will be one. And so you're in this gray zone where the attacks that we saw in Sri Lanka could occur again. Yeah, maybe ISIS is directing them. Maybe they're just inspiring them. There's lots of soft targets around the world. And that's the kind of zone we're going to be in, where they haven't disappeared. It's unlikely that they'll disappear. But they're not. There needs to be vigilance to make sure they don't regroup.
The Iraqi government, I think I saw, said that they could narrow down al-Baghdadi's location to one of four or five locations within Iraq. I heard that, and I thought, do they even know he's in Iraq? Do we have any idea?
I don't think we know that. We have not gotten confirmation on that. Nothing close to that. And like I said earlier, that's going to be the job of the intelligence services, is trying to unpack every single detail they can from a video like that. At the same time, think about the risk that Baghdadi is taking at this point in time for whatever the strength of ISIS is, for whatever their future will be. That man believed it was worth it to come forward at this point in time to deliver that message and put himself in risk that way.
Which indicates that he believes he has a strong incentive to do so, to, if not put ISIS back on the map, at least show the world, hey, we're still here, even if we don't have territory in eastern Iraq, western Iraq and eastern Syria. Let's move on to France, where widespread protests have continued all across that country. Wednesday, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets for annual May Day protests. This year, the protests turned violent, though, unlike in years past, with much of the blame falling on yellow vest protesters. French authorities responded to this violence with tear gas in the crowds. Nearly 400 protesters were arrested. Nina Maria, who are the different players in these demonstrations? They've been going on for quite a while. What explains the strength of these protests and the continuing nature of them week after week?
Well, I think one of the difficulties for Macron is that every time we think the movement is waning, they come roaring back into force. The thing that has slightly changed the equation in France is that public opinion is now stacking up against the yellow vests. I think the last poll I saw was that 60% of the French public actually would wish that they would rather go away. I think Macron has been taken by surprise at the level of venom and anger in the Yellow Vest movement. One of the difficulties with the May Day protests is that, of course, as you say, the May Day protests are a great tradition of the French. And, of course, this year they turned violent. I think the numbers put protesters out in the streets of Paris at 30,000. There was some 7,000 police out on the streets. And, as you say, it turned nasty and violent. The main gripe for the Yellow Vests is that Macron has ignored them. They're demanding social equality. He will not tackle the wealth tax, which is one of their biggest complaints, but he has tackled the fringes of pension cuts, and that's an issue that they hold very dear to their hearts. But their main preoccupation is that they feel abandoned by the urban elite. And Macron, although he seemed like a new style politician and brought a kind of a youth and energy to the French landscape, it is interesting to me, you know, I do wonder whether he will one day go the way of Dominique de Villepin and be allowed to somehow bleed to death. So,
Greg Myrie, it can be easy to lose when you see social media posts of some action by yellow vest protesters. Oh, look, he spray painted a car. This one blew up a storefront. Something makes social media rounds and goes viral. It can be easy to lose a connection not only to what the protesters actually want, which Nina Maria put a word on so ably, but whether any of these protests have even made a sign to leading toward any kind of political accommodation, or whether it's just a standoff, no change whatsoever.
Right. Well, they have won some concessions. I mean, a week or so ago, he did announce some income tax cuts, some worker bonuses, extra support for single parents. So they have won a few concessions, certainly not the extent of concessions they wanted, and they're still out there, and it's a mixed group. So even if one group may feel satisfied, others will not. Can they sustain this if a majority of the French are opposed to their demands? But I think Nina Maria really put it well, that it does, and on the larger picture, it seems to be a major obstacle for Macron instituting the large-scale types of changes that he came into office to do.
Well, if we go just across the channel into the UK, we will find Julian Assange, who found himself in front of a British court on Thursday for an initial hearing on possible extradition to the United States. He told a judge that he would not surrender himself to be prosecuted by American authorities. Now, just to remind people, Julian Assange was a key player in one of the greatest leaks of classified information in American national security history in 2010. Many of the documents revealed confidential information about United States wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The day before his hearing this past week, he was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for jumping bail. Next hearing is set for the end of the month. How much trouble is Julian Assange really in? There's a couple of things going on with
there
him.
There are a couple of things going on. Of course, the big thing to watch is how the extradition process is going to play out. It's going to take a very long time from all the experts I've talked to. At the heart of his arrest, though, is a real debate over what it means for First Amendment rights. And this is the kind of thing that's worth a conversation around the arrest, whatever happens with Julian Assange's case, because a lot of folks had a feeling it sent a chilling message to journalists that it matters not only that you may receive information that may have been illicitly gained, but that maybe you were a part of getting that information. Of course, Julian Assange was not arrested and is not wanted here for the leaking of the information. It was about how he went about getting it, that he worked with then Bradley Manning, later Chelsea Manning, to break into a Defense Department computer to get the information. Well, some journalists say, what happens if you work with someone on an encrypted chat to get information? What happens if you advise someone on how to fax a document to you? There's a lot of gray area around this one issue that's worth exploring, and that has sent some troubling messages.
And Julian Assange is also not charged with any role in the latest round of leaks from Hillary Clinton's campaign that led to so much of what we've read in the Mueller report. Greg Myrie, Omna raises some interesting problems around Julian Assange. A lot of other journalists look at his case and say, if you get information and publish information, even if it's not popular, that's journalism. When you choose a side and publish information one way because you're trying to steer politics in a certain direction, that's something different. And then we get into a meta conversation about Julian Assange's role and whether he belongs in handcuffs or somewhere else.
Right. I mean, the sort of distinction I would make would be, okay, who's the legal conversation about who's doing journalism, who is a journalist and who isn't, and what is legal and what isn't. That's one conversation to have. And then I think we can also have a general non-legal conversation about what journalism is. And, you know, Julian Assange with the WikiLeaks material was taking material and dumping it out. I mean, journalism is what you do with that material. It's how you process it, and rather than just dumping it out there. So in a sense, that my organization certainly wouldn't consider that journalism. But then again, I separate that from the legal question: does he have the right to do it, and does he have the right to operate that way? Again, just reinforcing the point Omna made up: he's not being charged with leaking the information. It was attempting to break into, or helping or assisting the break in of U.S. military documents.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. I want to take a moment and talk about former Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 87. Lugar was a Republican. He was elected to the Senate in 1976 and twice served as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And we got this note from Laura, who says, "We just lost one of our greatest statesmen with the death of Senator Lugar, someone who spoke with civility and humility, who reached across the aisle to get things done, whose reputation was that his word was bond, which led to both parties seeking him to help resolve issues. Nina Maria, talk about the legacy a little bit. Richard Lugar is from a different time in politics that, even though it wasn't that long ago, seems very far in the past.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think we live in a world where there aren't many old-style politicians left. They just don't make them like him anymore. And I think we saw that in the outpouring of grief and emotion and his passing, the same with John McCain. By stark contrast, I think the fear is that we live in a dangerous world, which is increasingly governed by strongmen and new-style politicians. His death has been dubbed the end of bipartisan foreign policy. I'd go a step further and say that it also marks the end or contributing factor to the end of multilateralism and the desire for coalition building and creating a global community. He's known, of course, for his very important work on non-proliferation. I'm sure Greg can address that. But I did want to just touch on his role in South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement as we approach the South African elections. He was instrumental, really, in galvanizing international opinion and also changing American policy on the apartheid government. And he was instrumental in overriding President Reagan's veto on targeted sanctions. And that was an incredibly important moment because it led to American companies disinvesting, universities disinvesting. And it was a pivotal moment in which America finally landed on the right side of history.
There was an op-ed in the Washington Post on Wednesday by former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn, who wrote about Richard Lugar and said, quote, he worked in good faith with both Republicans and Democrats, earning respect and trust for his grasp of detail and ability to find common ground. Here's Richard Lugar himself speaking at Georgetown University in 2013.
Very often bipartisanship is mistakenly used as a synonym for moderation or centrism. But one does not have to be a centrist to act in a bipartisan fashion. Almost every day at the United States Capitol, deals are cut as a part of the machinery of legislating. Most of these deals are tactical and are frequently motivated by political calculation. I would define true bipartisanship as the suspension of the pursuit of political advantage in the interest of doing something necessary for our country.
Senator Richard Lugar in 2013. Greg Myrie, Sam Nunn, foreign relations senator of the Democratic Party, wrote about his colleague Richard Lugar in the Washington Post. They are famous, those two names, for the Nunn-Lugar Accord, Nunn-Lugar program, the Nunn-Lugar law. What is it?
So after the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, there were all these nuclear weapons, nuclear materials that was not well taken care of. And there was a thought that it could be stolen, that it could be spread easily. So they gave money, and it was controversial in some quarters, to Russia to take better care of its nuclear material. It was, and I lived in Moscow in the 1990s, saw some of this. It was putting fences around nuclear facilities that were unfenced. It was putting supermarket barcodes on the material so it could be tracked. Really basic, important things. And perhaps one of the most extraordinary, it wasn't a direct but indirect part of this broader effort, those Soviet nuclear weapons, about 10,000 of them, the highly enriched uranium in them was blended down, sent to the United States to be used in nuclear plants. And until about 10 years ago, 10% of all the electricity in the United States was coming from nuclear power plants powered by former Soviet nuclear weapons.
Amna, former Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, but not for long. He found himself unable to be both bipartisan and a senator of the Republican Party. He's gone. And I just contrast that with the career of Richard Lugar. And I ask, is there any form of bipartisan foreign policy going on now in the United States relating to Syria or North Korea or Yemen or anywhere else? Do we see any spirit of the kind of cooperation that Lugar brought to this job?
I do think, because sometimes the headlines tend to focus on the many ways in which our government is divided right now, which do capture a lot of the national attention and many of our political headlines, a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes of the everyday government workings does get lost in the conversation. There are always some kind of ongoing bipartisan efforts, even in some controversial things. I've been hearing a lot about some members of Congress who are working on humanitarian issues on the border. border. You talk about immigration as an incredibly divisive and emotional topic right now. There are people who are working to try to bridge the gap between the two sides. None of that will take hold, though, until the highest powers find a way, and the leadership all the way up to the White House find a way to bridge some of the divides.
Yeah, that kind of cooperation is a reality on Capitol Hill, but they don't implement any of this. They rely on the White House and the administration to do it, and that question remains a big one, whether any of that bipartisan cooperation or action would ever be implemented if it did rise up on Capitol Hill. We're keeping an eye on the massive cyclone that threatens millions of people along the coast of India and Bangladesh. More than a million people have been moved from their homes, and it's likely to be a story that we talk about all of this week. Coming up, more on the Friday News Roundup with journalist Greg Myrie, Amna Nawaz, and Nina Maria Potts, and we'll be joined by Japan expert Sheila Smith. That's coming up. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. We have a quick line on a developing story before we get back to the day's international news on the Friday News Roundup. NPR says House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler has now sent Attorney General Bill Barr a letter presenting a counteroffer to obtain access to the unredacted portions of the Mueller report or face contempt of Congress. The letter says, in part, the committee is prepared to make every realistic effort to reach an accommodation with the Justice Department if the department persists in its baseless refusal to comply with a validly issued subpoena. The committee will move to contempt proceedings and will seek further legal recourse. We request a response by 9 a.m. on Monday, May 6th, 2019. So writes the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee to the attorney general. I have often wondered if this attorney general would care if Congress held him in contempt. Eric Holder was held in contempt by Republicans in the House, and it didn't seem to affect his life too much. This is the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. There's still time to get to your questions and comments about the abdication of Japan's emperor, a former CIA agent who pleaded guilty to spying for China, and accusations of heresy against Pope Francis. Comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. Our email address, 1A@WAMU.org. Amna Nawaz, national security correspondent and substitute anchor at the PBS NewsHour. Nina Maria Potts, director of global news coverage at Feature Story News, and Greg Myrie of NPR are my guests. And joining us here in the studio, Sheila Smith, senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Sheila, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Talk a little bit about Japan, where one era has ended and another has begun this week with the ascension to the throne of a new emperor there. The Japanese monarchy is believed to be the oldest hereditary monarchy in the world. I hope you tell us how old it is and tell us how unusual it is for Emperor Akihito to abdicate as he did this week.
Thank you. It is thousands of years old, and as far back as we can tell, it is the oldest monarchy in the world. Akihito is the second emperor in the post-war period, so after 1945, after Japan lost the war. And under the new Japanese constitution, his role was to be the symbol of the Japanese people. So he doesn't govern like his father did in the pre-war period. He actually tries to represent the country, but no direct political role. And so... For Akihito, who's just stepped down, and his son, who's just stepped up, this is personal interpretation of this role of symbolizing the Japanese nation that's been quite so fascinating for me to watch in the last couple of days. Akihito, as you pointed out, decided himself, many say 8 or 9 years ago even, that he wanted to step down in a transparent way, in a way that would be predictable for the Japanese people. And his father, of course, passed away. And it was a very uneasy time in Japan because people weren't quite sure what to do. So he wanted to avoid that. And there was a lot of resistance in the country.
It's known as the chrysanthemum throne in Japan. What will Akihito as emperor be most remembered for? Will it be this decision to abdicate, which is so very rare?
I think it's that In the way he was very methodical and rational about this process, in other words, taking away the mysticism and the kind of murkiness about the imperial family. But he and his wife, Empress Michiko, I think are going to be remembered for their compassion, first and foremost. They were very outgoing, very much associating themselves with the vulnerable populations of Japan. And we saw that after the earthquake in 2011. They went to the victims' shelters. They got down on their knees. They sat and they listened time and time again, offering their thoughts and condolences and support. Second thing he's going to be remembered for, though, is his position on the war. He is seen as somebody, he and Empress Michiko were seen as somebody who wanted to reconcile with Japan's neighbors. They were the first to go to China in 1992. His father, of course, couldn't go because his father prosecuted the war. His son has a very similar bent, I think. They see themselves as wanting to remind the Japanese people of the importance of learning a correct understanding of Japan's 20th century history.
There was a time in Japan's history where this royal family, the emperor, was viewed, if not as a god, godlike. And you're describing a situation where not only politically has that changed because of, you know, the governmental role and the ceremonial role, which is much different, but it seems like Japanese society has changed in their view of the monarchy, and indeed in the view of the monarchy of itself and its role.
That's true. I think the interesting thing about the abdication is the Emperor Akihito sort of treated it as if it was a job. You know, I have done my job. It is time for me to step down and let somebody else come in. His son uses the same language. You know, my job is to represent the Japanese nation. So it's a very different, I think, social understanding between the Japanese people today and the imperial family about what their relationship is. And people on the street, when the media was asking them questions, how do you feel about the abdication? How do you feel about this? They all said, oh, he's done a great job. He's 80-something years old. It's time for him and Empress Michiko to enjoy their retirement.
Japan is changing politically, though. Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, wants to change the constitution, has talked about altering Japan's post-war commitment to non-militarization, to I'm not saying they're getting aggressive, but the constitutional prohibitions on any aggressive military stance whatsoever. I don't know if the royals themselves have a role in this debate, but the political society is changing as well, and changing on the practical level where the politicians who have the power want to change Japan's status in the world.
That's right. So we're three generations after the war now. So you've got a very different mindset, I think, on the part of contemporary leaders in Japan, and especially for those coming up. I just finished a book on this question of the Japanese military and the Japanese debate over the use of military power. It's a very effective moment to be looking at the way in which the Japanese think about their military in the region, especially we watch the North Koreans move in the direction of acquiring nuclear weapons.
And China as well.
China is expanding it. So Japan has some serious thinking to do in terms of its defense policy and its relationship with us. But what you don't see in the constitutional debate is Japan wanting to get rid of Article 9, which is the no war clause that was imported by General MacArthur way back when. Nobody is arguing that Article 9 should be abolished. And the Japanese people certainly see Article 9 as a promise that they won't support a country that is going to use its military power offensively.
An emperor abdicates the throne in Japan as the prime minister contemplates a change in Japan's posture, especially when it comes to its neighbors, North Korea and places like China. And everyone around this table, you may not be experts in the Japanese monarchy the way Sheila is, but you are experts on China. So I want to take a moment and talk, Greg Myrie, with you about a very interesting story that you reported on NPR this week. It's a story of spying. Tell us about the ex-CIA officer who pleaded guilty a couple of days ago to spying for China. What does he admit to doing?
Right. So this was a case in U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia on Wednesday, and I was there for the case. Jerry Chunxing Li was a former CIA officer, spent 13 years with the agency, part of it in China. After he resigned in 2007, he settled in Hong Kong, where he'd been born and was a naturalized American, became a private businessman. 2010, he meets with Chinese intelligence officials, and they start giving him money. The FBI secretly goes into his hotel room when he visits the U.S. in 2012 and 2013. They find a couple books, notebooks with handwritten notes with the actual names of CIA covert officers, of CIA asset sources inside China. They don't arrest him at that point. They did arrest him when he came back to the U.S. again last year. He has pleaded guilty to conspiring to give information to the Chinese, acknowledged that in his plea. He'll be sentenced in August. It looks like a plea agreement talks about a sort of 21-year or so sentence, but the judge is free to give him anything up to life as he so chooses. What's interesting beyond that case itself, this is the third time in less than a year where a former U.S. intelligence official has either pleaded guilty or been convicted of spying for China. And so we've been hearing more and more about the Chinese spying efforts in the U.S., and we're sort of catching up with what's been happening for the past decade or so. These cases date back 5 or 10 years. The Chinese, in this case, we see, were very interested in this sort of traditional spying, getting government and military secrets. But it's very widespread, very much in terms of getting U.S. high tech, of getting information, cutting-edge research at universities. So sort of massive spying operation that no other country has really exercised against the United States, and the country is still coming to terms with the breadth of it and how to combat it.
Sheila Smith, we've heard about this direct spying that Greg is talking about. We've heard many, many stories about other forms, not only universities, agricultural research centers, lots of people on Capitol Hill concerned over the entire existence of Huawei, a Japanese communications company that Americans suspect is simply a front for the Japanese government. Anything they install in your office building might have listening devices. I'm reducing it. It's fairly reductive. Or in the U.S. government, what's your sense of how widespread Japanese espionage is in our society? Can we put a handle on it?
It's Chinese espionage.
What did I say?
Japanese.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Chinese.
I just want to make sure your listeners understand talking about China.
My mind was still with the chrysanthemum throne, and I didn't mean to cause an international incident. We are talking about Chinese espionage. Yes, exactly. I apologize for the error. Sheila, go ahead.
So the technological piece is, of course, the Chinese are moving out towards the forefront of technological innovation in the 5G sector. And so it becomes very hard to regulate that because, of course, we've always been in the we've been in the front line and we haven't worried about ourselves so much. But the China now has assets and has capabilities, and other countries are interested in those capabilities. So the conversation with the UK and China on Huawei, for example, makes us very worried, because all of a sudden we're looking at the next generation of communications and information technologies that could be dominated by Chinese systems, or at least integrated or penetrated by Chinese systems in a way that we can't manage. But I think back to the sort of traditional spy stories of the kind of human assets, the Chinese have obviously been very, very active in recruiting our former intelligence officers and such. They've been very, very active for a long time on cyber, and they both in the traditional sort of state to state spying, but also in the commercial espionage.
You're listening to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Nina Maria Potts, you were just in China, right?
That's right.
Are these stories, I don't assume, are reported in the same way that they're reported here, but are they reported at all? What's the espionage culture in the news media like there?
Well, it's a good question. There is a substantial effort underway by the Chinese government to talk about stories focused on hostile activities by foreigners. And I think back to Greg's point, I mean, one of the striking things about that particular case was the decimation of the CIA from 2010 to 2012, which came as a bit of a body blow to the CIA and has been compared to the situation, I think, in Russia in the 1980s. So that was very striking. The other thing to say about having just recently been in Beijing is that there is a hostile environment, I would say, that there are fears among journalists and foreign delegations and diplomats about Chinese aggression. There have been detentions and arrests and death sentences. This is against a backdrop of worsening relations between the US and China, but also Canada and China, where we've seen a second death sentence this week against a Canadian national. And I think one of the most alarming and perhaps depressing takeaways is that even among sinologists, people that have studied China, who love China, who have really invested years in hoping for engagement and dialogue, are beginning to walk away and worry about the future of U.S.-China relations.
Amna.
Yeah, obviously at the heart of that tension between the U.S. and China is the scope of that intelligence gathering. Christopher Wray, the FBI director, said recently that it is enormous in its scale, that they use every possible asset that they have, researchers, private companies, state-owned entities as well. The Huawei question is going to be one to watch, because that is something, look, three of the Five Eyes networks, right, the U.S., New Zealand, and Australia have banned that company's technology being used in their firms, specifically because of those spying concerns. I interviewed Ajit Pai recently of the FCC. As the U.S. is investing now billions of dollars in growing and expanding that necessary 5G fifth generation network here in the U.S., we have to remember we have no domestic manufacturing capability to support that here in the U.S. We're entirely dependent on foreign firms. Nokia and Ericsson are not nearly where Huawei is. They are the leader in this space. That's going to be a problem for the U.S. moving forward.
Sheila Smith, final thoughts on how the United States manages this huge problem of Chinese espionage that's widespread throughout industries and politics and intelligence agencies and culture, when we have trade concerns, when we have military concerns, when we frankly want to do business with them.
Well, I think it's going to restrict a lot of the ways that we've interacted with Chinese and Chinese citizens. So whether it's educational exchanges, business investment in China and vice versa, Chinese investment here, it's going to start to really constrict the activities that I think our government is going to feel comfortable with.
Well, I want to thank you all for being around the table with me. I apologize for pinning espionage on Japan when I meant China. Shouldn't have done that, but hopefully the embassy has hung up their phones and they know that I just made a mistake. Before we go, though, I want to make sure that we get to this one last story.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man-beast of Tibet, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you?
Now, people have been searching for the abominable snowman for centuries. Some call it the Yeti. Well, now, a group of mountaineers from the Indian Army says they found evidence of the beast. On Monday, the Indian Army announced from an official Twitter account that its expedition team in Nepal had stumbled upon, quote, mysterious footprints of the mythical beast Yeti. The tweet included three photos of large footprints in the snow, as well as a photo of the mountaineering group, a selfie. Of course, the Nepalese army dismissed these claims right away, saying the footprints probably belonged to a wild bear, which hangs out in that area. Now, Nepal and India, though, will have to hash out their Yeti sightings, but no Yeti on Earth has ever done more for the galaxy than the interstellar Bigfoot, the Wookiee, Chewbacca. The co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon was played by actor Peter Mayhew in five Star Wars films. Peter Mayhew passed away at his home in Texas on Tuesday. He was 74. Everybody in this galaxy and in galaxies far, far away will miss Peter Mayhew. I want to thank all of you for joining me on the international edition of the Friday News Roundup. Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage at Feature Story News. Nina Maria, great to see you. Greg Myrie, thanks for being here, National Security Correspondent for NPR. And of course, Amna Nawaz, National Correspondent and Substitute Anchor on the great PBS NewsHour. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This
Thank
program
you.
Comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR as we go out on a tribute to Chewbacca. What a Wookiee he was. I'm Todd Zwillick. Joshua is back on Monday. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is 1A.